This is How Success Happens, where we talk to polar explorers, war correspondents, founders, ultramarathoners, authors, artists, and a range of other unique personalities to help you understand the capabilities behind how success happens.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
When I'm training for an ultramarathon, anywhere from 100 to 120 miles a week would be in my training cycle. Lots of miles.
You sold something like 250,000 books.
I'm the managing editor at entrepreneur.com and your host, Linda Lacina. Today, we'll talk to Liz Maida. Liz is the founder of Uplevel Security. This cybersecurity startup is the first of its kind to use an emerging system of intelligence utilizing graph theory. She'll talk about what that is exactly and the opportunity that she saw that led her to be a first-time founder. She'll also explain what a sharing economy for cybersecurity might look like and what's standing in its way, and also how someone in her line of business weighs risk. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Linda.
So we're excited to have you. I think this is going to be a great chat. Can we just get people caught up on the little path that you had up to founding Uplevel?
Sure, absolutely. So I actually started in undergrad studying civil engineering, of all things,
yes.
And quickly transitioned after graduation to computer science. I had taken some computer science courses in undergrad, and I loved this idea of logical reasoning and also this sense of accomplishment that you could actually think through a program, put it into a computer, and see the output. Like, you actually had feedback on your activity in real time. I went and worked at Akamai Technologies for many years. I started in really kind of the early days of the company, which was just an amazing experience. Akamai gave me this opportunity to actually get real hands-on experience in computer science in a company that had a transformational impact on the internet. And based on that, actually led to me going to graduate school in computer science. I had kind of seen all of the real life applications, and it was more of I wanted to get that theoretical understanding of the underlying concepts. Akamai also, I think, had this culture that really encouraged intellectual curiosity and the pursuit of excellence and independence, right? Is that if you saw an opportunity, you were not bound by the structure of your role or your title. It was much more of figure out how to get something done and go do it. And I think that really, that environment contributed tremendously to my overall desire of actually going out and doing something on my own.
Tell us a little bit about graph theory. What should we know?
Yes, absolutely. So within mathematical circles, it's very well understood. I would say the majority of, you know, other people are not familiar with it. Although what's really interesting, it is the underlying concept behind a lot of the very common applications people use, like Facebook and LinkedIn, yeah. Right? It's essentially how do you understand the relationships between different entities? So if you think about Facebook or LinkedIn, a big part of what you care about is who are the people you know and how do you know them? And do you know other people through those people? Mm-hmm. So it really is the mathematical representation of, you know, the Kevin Bacon 6 degrees of separation. Yeah. Because, for example, you might say, hey, there's, you know, this guy, Joe, that I met. It was in a business context. All right, that relationship, how you actually know them, is actually really critical in allowing you to differentiate between the 6 Joes you might be connected to in different circumstances. And interestingly enough, it just so happens that in many ways, cybersecurity data, in my perspective, is almost an ideal fit for this idea of graph theory and how you understand the relationships between all the technical attributes. Mm-hmm.
And this was something that hadn't really been used in cybersecurity.
Not really. I mean, it's been used obviously a lot in other disciplines. I mean, the social network is, I think, one of the most salient examples of it. There's been a lot of other analytical techniques applied within the cybersecurity domain, but not really graph theory to that same extent.
Yes. And why is that?
Well, I mean, I think cybersecurity is such an interesting area where, first of all, I think a lot of people assume that it's an incredibly technically advanced discipline, and in many aspects it is, you know, especially if you think about all of the work that's been done on the prevention and detection side of things, of analyzing network traffic to figure out what might be anomalous behavior. What's really interesting, though, is that once an actual alert is fired, you know, something malicious has been detected, it really becomes like a very manual, time-consuming process of individuals going and looking in spreadsheets and looking through emails and things like that to try and piece together what the actual attack looked like and compile their investigative analysis. And that's, first of all, really the area that we're focused on, but it also is kind of the area where graph theory becomes most relevant, because that is the piece where you're almost putting together this, you know, evidence board of how all of these details actually link together.
Yeah, that's interesting. And so despite the fact that this had been used in, you know, other industries and in very, very visible places like social network, you sort of saw an opportunity there for cybersecurity. You know, what was going through your mind? Like, tell me a little bit about what fueled that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was actually personally very exciting for me, because I think in some ways it was very similar to Akamai. One of the things I loved about Akamai is that it was based on pure academic research and these, you know, extremely complicated mathematical algorithms that were being applied to a real life business problem, in that case of really congestion on the, you know, the internet. And in our case, it's very similar from the perspective of there are some really interesting, challenging computer science problems around graph theory, around how you actually design and model graphs, around how you apply machine learning to graphs, which is a particularly exciting area from my perspective. But it's all towards the goal of how do you increase the efficacy of these security operations analysts who really today are in this position where they're getting hundreds or thousands of alerts on a weekly basis, and they're trying to piece together this incredibly complex puzzle. And so seeing some of the work that they really are trying to do in terms of piecing things together, and some of, you know, the open source tools that they do to try and do things like link analysis, it became very evident that there was this really exciting opportunity to not just help a very critical area, but also hopefully really do some interesting things on the computer science side.
Yeah. Was it a matter of folks not seeing the opportunity there for this to be integrated, or was it that they saw it and they, for whatever reason, didn't want to pursue it?
I mean, I think the reality is that the security operations teams are completely overwhelmed today with just, you know, even the initial work that they have to do, right? Like, their primary job is trying to deal with all of the alerts that are coming in and ensuring that, to the best of their ability, they identify anything that could be a potentially significant incident, and if it is one, resolve it immediately. And quite honestly, that leaves them very little time for anything else. There aren't enough people in the cybersecurity workforce to deal with the current demand. And so it means in many ways as well is that incident response in general, I think, has long been kind of a process-oriented domain, where it's kind of been like, you get an alert, here's the steps that you follow through in order to really run that alert to ground. And so there's been a lot of efforts by various people of how do you shorten the number of steps, or how do you automate the number of steps? But it's still kind of a process-oriented view in my mind. And I think what's really different about what we're doing is, what if you took a completely different approach to it and thought of it as a true data analysis problem, right? Where it's no longer how do you just speed up this whole series of steps? How do you actually transform the underlying analysis that ultimately results in the security operations analyst having a very different, you know, in some ways, you know, more exciting job where they can focus on the real analysis that they really care about a lot.
Yeah. And on the response side, what's the risk of sort of not maybe innovating and forging through on the response side?
Yeah, I mean, it's I think, a real risk and a real challenge from kind of the overall organization and enterprise perspective of it dramatically increases the likelihood that there could be a significant breach through no fault of the people at all. I mean, attackers have to be right once, right? Defenders have to be right all the time. That is basically an impossible situation for them to manage. But, you know, not kind of continuing to innovate and introduce new technologies and techniques to help deal with the ever-increasing sophistication of the attacks puts the organizations at a real disadvantage. And I think from a people perspective, it's also, you know, there's there's very limited resources in terms of people on the cybersecurity side, and you want to be giving them the really exciting work that they're capable of doing, right? You want them doing that human involved advanced analysis to piece together sophisticated attacks that, you know, no machine, you know, could potentially do. You don't want them just kind of going through and doing the same manual time-consuming tasks day after day.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the cybersecurity professional, right? You guys are a little bit different than usual tech people that I think people have in their mind, right? You know, you process the world a little bit differently. So if you were in a room, right, how do you recognize your own?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think some of the very clear giveaways are, you know, the laptop webcam is always covered. Never using public Wi-Fi at all under any circumstances, right? Like tethering to your phone, you know, is somewhat acceptable. Having multiple devices for different, you know, situations. I think kind of just like the awareness, I would say, of the actual electronic environment is much greater. Yeah. I think it's also really interesting when you engage in conversations, the level of technical depth that quickly surfaces, and kind of always questioning or to some extent verging a little bit like a healthy dose of paranoia, right?
Sure.
Which I think comes about because people have a really good understanding of how easy it actually is to infiltrate almost anything.
Sure. And how would that sort of play itself out? Like, say, if you were at a work meeting or something, right? Like, how would those discussions kind of go?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's very much like the level of inquisition. The level of questioning goes into a much deeper level of detail of wanting to really understand exactly what's going on behind the scenes. And I think in some ways, making sure that you also have an awareness of where the weaknesses are, right? It's not necessarily questioning to be like, oh, aha, I got you. You never knew that this existed. It is a problem, though, if you're in those conversations and you're trying to say, no, everything is perfect, because nothing is perfect. Everything is hackable. There are always challenges and weaknesses. And I think it's, you know, be realistic about that. It's okay that they exist, but make sure that you recognize them when you can.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting thing because I think that in a lot of situations, it personally and professionally, questioning is seen in maybe a lot of charged ways, you know? And it's still an important skill to find out the weaknesses because, as you're saying, like, weaknesses all around us, all over. So what do you think about that? You know, like, can more people have a smidge more of that?
Yeah, well, I think it's really interesting. I think both on the questioning side and also kind of the attitude and response to questioning.
Yeah.
Because I think, in many ways, I think questioning can be really fun, right? It's an opportunity to express your view. And then also you learn a lot from the questions that your audience is asking, right? And that I think beyond anything is one of the things I find most fascinating is actually unwinding the motivation behind a particular question and how the more you kind of get into that discussion, the more you can quickly put yourself in that person's shoes and understand what they're really trying to get at. I personally actually think it's far worse if you're not getting any questions because that is almost kind of an indication of indifference and they don't think what you're saying is interesting at all. And questioning is really this opportunity to actually have a discussion. And oftentimes that's when you're learning
sure.
a lot of things.
Now, how do you do that? Like, so when someone's asking you, then you're trying to unwind it. What is going through your mind so that you can sort of get to the nugget that is driving them?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really, it changes, right? I think a lot of times you can kind of initially assess, you know, the person's perspective of, are they questioning me because they're trying to demonstrate they know more than you, which could definitely be the case, or is it because they have a particular concern behind the scenes? I usually use a combination of just answering their question to some degree, but then trying to also ask a follow-up question to see if I can understand the motivation, because that can also help me figure out what's the additional level of detail I can provide that truly answers what they're really asking.
Yeah. No, that's really, really interesting. And I think that level of maybe evaluation of questioning is very useful.
Yes, it's really, I mean, it's one of the things that I love about interacting with customers. Is that questioning to figure out what they ask. And the most fun situations are when you get the questions that you've never heard before. And you have to kind of figure out right then, how do I answer this? Like, what is this person really asking? How do I answer this? What is the follow-up question? That's almost also where all of a sudden you see these new opportunities of new ways you could have explained something or new things that you should be doing differently in the product or the positioning.
Yeah, definitely. So you've written some interesting things about the sharing economy and that there should be a sharing economy for cybersecurity. How so?
I think right now, we're very much in a situation where you have these very sophisticated threat actors out there that are deploying attacks against multiple, different, very large enterprises, oftentimes in a coordinated effort. And yet on the other side, a lot of enterprises are working in isolation to try and fight back. And first of all, that's just a challenge in terms of resources altogether. But I think also there is this really interesting advantage where when you start pooling your resources and, for example, contributing and sharing information and data across companies, all of a sudden actually uncovers things that previously you didn't think were malicious at all that become clearly malicious with that greater context. And that allows you to not just uncover things you may have missed, but also can almost act as kind of an early warning or early prediction of what you might experience soon. I think cybersecurity, there have been efforts over the years to encourage information sharing that have been hindered by a number of different factors. One, just like the challenge of the lack of machine-readable data means it's very time-consuming to actually share that information. But I think the other aspect is more almost social and emotional of there was a lot of focus about sharing incident data. And what that means, in many people's kind of interpretations of it at least, was that by sharing any cybersecurity data, you were essentially declaring that you had been breached. Which obviously is extremely sensitive and not necessarily something that you want to be talking about. And I think we need to transition that conversation to it's not about sharing incident data. It's about sharing all of this cybersecurity intelligence that your internal teams were actually so sophisticated and advanced, that they were able to actually uncover it and now they can share it for the benefit of others. And I think we're definitely starting to see the movement in that area, but it really is kind of this shift from let's not try and pretend we're perfect because we all know we're not. It's about how can we continually learn from what we've experienced and how can we actually help others with that information.
Yeah. What is going to be needed for that shift to happen?
So I think definitely just from kind of the organization's perspective, that willingness and understanding that actually contributing the data towards kind of this greater good is something that an individual organization wants to get involved in, and kind of distinguishing between the sharing of data, the sharing of technical attributes about the attack is not necessarily at all the equivalent of sharing that you've been breached. So I think there's kind of those social changes, but I think there's also a lot of technical changes that need to occur in terms of making sure organizations have their own internal data about their past incidents that they can then selectively identify specific technical attributes that they're willing to share with other organizations.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think it's also an element of maybe two different sort of worlds colliding, where the folks who understand that breaches are going to happen are like, okay, no, we need to share this information. And the folks who are not familiar with, the fact that, hey, this is going to happen, they're a little bit more protective.
Yes.
It's a different conversation that needs to be sort of had.
Yes, absolutely. Well, and I think it's really interesting because, just given the number of breaches that have occurred, it started that conversation to a greater extent. And I think, you're already starting to see at least some of that transition at the executive level, at the board level, where it's no longer, pushing on the CISO to say, give me 100% assurance that we're not going to be breached. It has shifted to how do we actually manage and mitigate our risk, right? Let's ensure we're doing everything we can that if this circumstance should happen, we can identify it, we can resolve it quickly. From any reasonable assessment, we will have done our absolute best to minimize the damage.
Yeah, and part of that is also the storytelling of risk, right? Because there's risk everywhere, but I think a lot of times in big picture in corporations or companies, we would like to maybe tell the story of everything's fine, nothing to see here, right? And I think that what part of that also do you think needs to change a little bit, that we need to change this narrative that there's not hacks?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is like this realization and acceptance of risk, of it exists and it's okay. You almost want to shift. You want to shift where the acceptance lies of, instead of kind of insisting that, no, everything must be perfect and don't tell me otherwise, it's almost, if somebody's telling you there's no risk, that's what raises your concern, because that can't possibly be the case.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, entrepreneurs are, they can't function without some risk, right? They're maybe a little bit more comfortable with it than most folks. But with cybersecurity, right, you have even a different understanding of it. You know, so do you think you have an advantage in sort of understanding the nature of risk? Because not only are you an entrepreneur, but you're also, in the cybersecurity space.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting question. I mean, I guess it's kind of always knowing that the risk is always there. Yeah. It always exists, and you're just trying to mitigate it to the best of your ability. I think also being comfortable with the fact that things are going to go wrong all the time. Right? It's like you just kind of accept that. Like, you will not be perfect. What you do will not be perfect. The most important critical factor is, how do you actually deal with it when something bad happens, and how do you learn from it to improve in the future? It's like, how are you continually evolving based upon what you've done in the past, becomes, I think, the most critical aspect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That acceptance of things going wrong, right? What impact do you think, so if more people had that acceptance, right, what impact do you think that would have on petty frustrations in the workday across America?
yes. I think there would be, there would still be a lot of petty frustrations in the workplace, but I think there might be a greater segmentation of which ones do you really let get to you versus which ones are you actually kind of excited and proud of, right? Yeah. Of, if it's a frustration because somebody tried something new and it didn't work out and was a total disaster, that is actually very different in my mind from somebody just kind of not working very hard and not trying their best, right? And that I think is a really important distinction of, if somebody's doing their absolute best and they're continually learning, you want to encourage that with everything. And that actually means they will probably fail a lot.
Yeah. And if they're trying, it's hard to be mad.
Yes. No, it's very true, right? I mean, at least for me personally, I think it's much more frustrating if somebody is not trying or not working up to what you can clearly see is their ability. You know, it's one of kind of my main motivations, actually, of why I ultimately wanted to go out and do something on my own, was actually this idea of, I wanted to be in a situation where I knew I was in completely over my head, right? So it's like almost like you're essentially asking for a situation where you are guaranteed to fail in many different respects, but it's like that's how you figure out and push your boundaries and learn over time.
No, of course. How do you sort of weigh risk, manage risk? Do you have a process? Do you have a way you look at it?
I don't know that I have a process so much. I mean, I think, you know, I do my best. It depends on the nature of the risk, right? You know, first of all, let's assess the scale of the risk and how big an issue it really is. And then it's very much of kind of thinking through, like, what are the risks of not doing something, right? And then how do you mitigate that risk, right? Like, what's the risk of doing it? What's the risk of not doing it? The risks of doing it, can you mitigate them, right? And can you kind of come to a conclusion that way? But I think in many ways, it's like, if the risk, within a certain kind of span, if the risk is minimal, you just do it and try. And if it fails, you've kind of assumed, you've gone in with the assumption, there's a good chance we'll fail. And here's what we do in that scenario, and we keep moving.
Yeah. That last part that you just said, the keep moving part, I think that gets lost sometimes, right? How important is a bias toward action?
Oh, incredibly important. I think one of the most, it's because you can debate and think about things forever and question yourself forever. And like, reality is, you have to just do it. Like, just do it. Stop talking. I mean, not to say don't be thoughtful.
No,
right?
Of course. Yeah.
But it's like, honestly, that is the biggest difference, I would say, in just everybody I've worked with throughout my career.
Sure. Yeah.
The people who can think of something and then actually go and execute on it.
Of course.
That's amazing. Because oftentimes, if you can have these incredible ideas, but for me, it's like, once you actually see it, that's the hard part. How do you execute it and act on it and keep moving and learn from that and make it better and better and better?
Sure, sure. And do you think that in part of executing it, that it also comes down to sort of like putting your time into the project and not getting lost in the wrong types of problem solving, where like I'm upset that the thing broke.
Yes.
Well, you can be upset all you want, but unless you fix it, you can't move forward,
yes.
Right? You know, and so having the right sort of putting your energy toward the right thing.
Absolutely. Like, so in that example, it's like, okay, you can waste all of your time being upset about how something didn't work, but like that is not changing. It still doesn't work, right? So your only option here is you have to fix it and you have to keep going. Yeah. And I think that is a kind of this critical acceptance of you are going to encounter failure all the time. You have to stop taking it so personally.
Yeah. And again, taking that shame element out of it, like we have with the hacks,
yes.
Right? You know, how do we do that? How do we take the shame
really,
element out?
No, it's really hard because, I mean, I think in some ways, like, you know, when you're building your own company, you kind of become a nerd to it because it happens so
often,
right?
Of course, absolutely.
Whereas
if
you don't experience it very often, it's like far more shameful because you're like, oh no, I tried and I failed. Whereas if you're failing continuously, it's far easier to.
You're like, I did that yesterday too. It was crazy.
It's like last week was far worse.
We should have seen the other guy. Oh my God. Yeah.
Exactly. It's all relative then. Yeah. But obviously you can't necessarily, nor do you want to take that attitude with security breaches, right? But I do think it is measuring what have we learned since last time, right? Or how did we get better? Or what else could we do to get better? Like essentially asking that question of how do we keep moving, right? And doing that regardless of whether you actually experienced a breach or something smaller, but encouraging that creativity and that action and the keep doing things. Like never stand still. This is a very unrelated analogy, but I played soccer for many years. Yeah. And it was really interesting because it was the mother of one of my teammates was actually the coach, which was a bit unusual because we were like, you know, a very sophisticated, you know, girls soccer team. Yeah. And she taught us a lot about like the intellectual aspect of the game. And one of the biggest things was every single person on the field, regardless of whether you have the ball or you're actually actively in the play, has to be moving at all times. And it's interesting because I think there is, especially in a startup, an analogy to that of like you need to be constantly questioning and figure things out and trying something new, regardless of what your formal role actually is.
Yeah. No, I love that. I love that. That idea that you just have to have activity. Just
yes.
Move,
just,
do, be.
Yes. Well, it's like some direction is better than none, even if sometimes it's in the wrong direction.
Yeah. That's interesting. And is there also sort of a lesson there in using a screw up, a gap, anything like that, as a way to strengthen risk management, right? So it's not just like, okay, what do we do next time? But really saying the words risk management. I think that's a lost piece of this puzzle, that people can think of this in a little bit of a different way of their informing their future and making things better for their future you, for their future company, whatever. Like, tell me about that piece.
Yeah. I mean, I think it is very much, right? It's like, it's not just like what went wrong or what do we do better, but it's what was the actual risk there, right? Like what happened? What was the actual risk? Do we need to address the risk in a different way? Or are we actually completely comfortable accepting that degree of risk, right? And that can actually inform then your decisions in the future of, you know what, we are okay with that level of risk because here's what the payoff might be. And I think also understanding and quantifying, you know, how that level of risk will shift over time, right? And that it is a flexible and dynamic idea versus something that's just like very hard and fast of here's the risk we accept, that's what we're going with, is it will change and depending upon the situation and the requirements.
Yeah. And does that also maybe change the nature of what a comeback is, right? So a comeback isn't like a, you made a mistake, right? And now there's the life before and after the thing, right?
Yeah.
That we don't have this binary situation. We have a process and evolution. Like, does that sort of change this?
Yes, I think so. I mean, you know, you look at it as like it is a whole series of mistakes that you're making one after another that's building on top of each other to actually get you to something where I think in a lot of circumstances, like to somebody outside the situation, they will never even see any of those mistakes. They will only see the success that occurs kind of at interim periods or at the end, right? And I think accepting that, like, that is actually the path that you need to follow in order to get to kind of any of those interim stages of success is really important, just even from a mindset perspective. I always love the quotes of, like, you know, the obstacles are there to kind of assess how much you really want something, right? And, like, the biggest difference between people who ultimately are successful and those that aren't are the ones that just kept going, which is interesting, right? It's not like they're smarter or they necessarily did kind of all these unique things. It's like, no, they just actually kept going and persevered despite all of the challenges.
Yeah, I've always found that living or working in New York is sort of like that. The city constantly sort of asks you, do you still want this?
Yes. Like, is this really... Every morning on the subway, it's like, are you sure this is for you?
There's a marching band walking through the train. Do you still want this? Okay.
Yeah. Good
luck
with that.
Yeah. Cheerio. Exactly. Yeah. Some people, that's their breaking point. They have the mariachi band. They have the marching
and
band.
Forget it. Yeah.
I gotta go somewhere else. Yeah. I gotta have some quiet. I can't do this, which is funny. Yeah. As a founder, you've needed to develop a different skill set, a different approach to work than you had in your previous lives. You know, what are some of those skills that you, those muscles you needed to strengthen?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of them is definitely around people management. Yeah. And kind of how, what's interesting, I think, is like a founder in a startup is like how that actually differs than being a manager of people in a larger company. Yeah. Because I think, for me personally, I feel like a much greater sense of responsibility of, like, these people have essentially trusted me with some portion of their career at this point in time that I am personally responsible for. And they're being put in really challenging situations on a daily basis, right? It's like, so how do you figure out how to minimize, like, kind of lift off as much of the external risk from them as possible? How do you figure out what drives different people and kind of what your role is? I think also as being a founder, you're necessarily looking for kind of different types of people that you want to bring on board than you would at a larger company, right? Because everybody needs to do so much. You want people that are, you know, internally driven and can figure out what to do on their own and are self-motivated, and you can give high-level guidance, and that is it. Like, that, your role is not to tell them what to do. It is to give them high-level guidance and trust them that they know far more about how to figure out that particular problem than you do, and let them really own that work ultimately.
How do you know when you've made the right decision?
I mean, I think you can see it when you give people the flexibility, like when you're not telling them, hey, fill out this template and come back to me with this information, but you're more like, here is the problem that needs to be solved. You go do your work, right? And I'm here to answer questions that you may have, but you do it, and you do it the way that you want to and that you feel proud of when you come back, right? It's like that pride of, like, this is what I actually created. You can see a lot about people in that work product, right? Of, like, what do they consider their absolute best work? And how much guidance, not do they need on, like, the topic or the theme or kind of questions like that, but, like, how much guidance do they need in terms of what format does it need to be in, right? Versus how much do they want to have, like, full creative ownership and almost create something that only, you know, represents them.
Yeah. How have you changed? How are you different now as a founder than you were, like, all the time before?
Yeah. I mean, I think I definitely spend a lot more time thinking about, like, organizational dynamics and people versus just, you know, initially you're so focused on, like, product and customers, right? And I think part of that is also, how do you start thinking about ensuring that everybody understands the longer term vision for what you're building? How do you think about communication? Communication is something I spend an overwhelming amount of time thinking about that I never would have imagined. Yeah. But it's so critical. I mean, it is like the underpinning of getting your company to run and grow is how you communicate with other people. I think also definitely putting, like, small mistakes or failures in perspective. I mean, that's definitely something that has dramatically changed in the past few years. Because I do think, you know, like when I was younger, it's like I would take very small things that I did wrong very seriously. Like, I didn't like making mistakes. And that is definitely something that has changed over time, where depending upon the size of the mistake, I might be more upset or not. But it is a matter of, okay, this happened. How do we get through it?
Yeah. No, that's really interesting. And you talked a little bit about communication and that you think about that sort of an overwhelming amount of time. So how so, and how does that sort of play itself out?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's communication in terms of, as a founder, when you have all of this additional context in your mind of what you want to build and how you see this evolving over time, and it's sometimes hard to remember that not everybody else has all of that context, and that you oftentimes have to say it multiple times and in different ways because people are bringing all of their own perspectives and opinions and kind of an experience. And so especially as the company grows, how do you kind of ensure that people are still all working towards the same end goal? And how do you actually build kind of a culture that continues to encourage like intellectual curiosity and excitement and drive and motivation? And a lot of that, I mean, a lot of that just comes through communication. I think one of the most interesting things for me is, and it's related to like how people learn, is very similar to how they communicate, right? And figuring out what's the best way to actually communicate with people so that from their perspective, they're hearing the same thing as what you're trying to say, right? And, you know, a lot of people say it's not about what you say, it's about what people hear. Yeah. When you say it. And that's hard because you don't actually know.
Yeah. How do you know the communication is successful?
I mean, I think one of the biggest ways is when you've been working with somebody and you have a brief conversation and they go off and do some work and come back and it's not only exactly how you would have imagined it, but that it's far better because it's like they have internalized things and they've been able to think, you know, and build upon that. That's when you know communication is working.
Yeah. To make that the goal.
Exactly.
Is the seed there. Yeah.
Exactly. It's like the seed is there, but they were able to take that and do so much, like far beyond something that you would have ever come up with yourself.
Yeah. How do you prioritize, right? Your day is a little bit different. Like, how do you sort of structure what your priorities are?
Yeah. I mean, it really depends on a day-to-day and week-to-week basis. I mean, it really is also this combination of things that are just generally for the company, right? Whether that be investor focus or product focus or customer focus. And I try and do a real mix of those. I think one of my challenges is I can't spend too long on any one thing. Like I would love to just take 2 weeks and focus entirely on like product road mapping and development. I cannot, right? And so I will do my best though to try and spend at least like a few hours or one day a week on something so that I do have enough time to think it through. I think the other part of it, though, is really thinking about people, right, and motivation and kind of what else do you do to kind of help everybody else around you?
Can you take us through your day and sort of how you structure your day?
Sure. So, you know, usually I'm up at around 5 or 5:30 to go running in Central Park, which is, you know, it is terrible waking up that early, but it is also kind of the part of the day that allows me to reset. And I do oftentimes a lot of my best thinking when I'm running, which is really fun. Like I love having actually something that's going on at work that I need to think through because I will often come to that conclusion during my run. And there's nothing better than Central Park in the morning with the sun rising. Yeah. It's a moment of quiet and calm in the city that you're always asking of, you know, should I still be here? Then usually during the school year, I'll drop my daughter off at school. And then I usually get into the office around 8:30. And it's nice because I usually have about an hour or so to myself, which is great. I do my best work in kind of the early morning before anybody's there. Well, I will get organized for the day. There may be one or two things that I know I want to accomplish because I'll kind of have reviewed them late the night before. And then I'll also figure out, you know, what's my schedule look like? What are my meetings? What are like my blocks of time? What are the things that I have to kind of dynamically shift in? And then I usually, you know, I try and get home around 7. Sometimes it's far later, which I try and avoid, but try to get home around 7, spend time with my family, and then usually work for a little bit later in the evening.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's amazing. I think structuring the day so that you've got those times that are just for you, right? Whether it's just to have the reset or also to actually get things done. Yes. I think that is like a missing piece. Everyone talks about, oh, like find balance, go for a run, you know, look at the moon, right?
Yes. Yeah.
But no one ever says like, no, get in an hour earlier before the madness starts, right?
Yeah. No, it is. It is. It's like, it's my hour in the morning. It's like the 2 hours late at night. That's actually when, like, if I'm doing work, right, that's the time that I get, because all of my other hours really should be dedicated towards doing stuff with other people.
Of course, absolutely, and helping them.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. For somebody else who is a first-time founder and sort of navigating through all this, beating themselves up, wondering if they're making the right decisions, sure that, you know, everything is just swirling into oblivion, you know, what can you tell them to comfort them?
I mean, I think I would say, like, probably most things are a disaster, but it's okay. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, you're
right. That's probably about it. Yeah.
That seems like a pretty accurate assessment of the situation, but that's okay. I guess that's the whole thing, is that is what's expected. And so don't be scared of it, right? It's like, it's similar to like, don't agonize over like what a mess things are. It's more of like, this is it. And you know, other places are worse. So let's just pick things up and keep moving.
Keep going.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, Liz, that's all the time we have, but this has been great. And I really appreciate all of your insights. I think this will be really helpful to a lot of people. And for others who are listening to this, please listen to more podcasts from this series. Find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and follow us on SoundCloud.